Welcome to CyberFocus from the McCrary Institute, where we explore the people and ideas shaping and defending our digital world. I'm your host, Frank Salufo, and I have the privilege to sit down today with Bill Evanina. Bill spent 25 years at FBI and most recently retired as the director of the National Counterintelligence and Security Center. Bill's been around a whole host of big issues, ran a number of major counterterrorism investigations, started as a sniper, went on to lead the SWAT team of FBI, and then went to the Central Intelligence Agency to oversee their counter-espionage group, and then to what was then the National Cyber Intelligence Directorate, which was transformed into the National Counterintelligence and Security Center. And he was the first Senate-confirmed position in that role. Bill, real privilege to have you here today. Two paisans with mics. To quote my dad, "Buckle up, Buttercup." It could get a little entertaining. And the likes. Thrilled to have you here, Bill.
Frank, it's an honor and privilege. Thanks for the invite. Thanks from the McCrary Institute and Auburn University for not only hosting this podcast but having the opportunity for me to be here and spend some time with you and talk Italian food.
Well, it's a privilege to have you. And I like to start every interview with a little bit of everyone's North Star, their why. What pulled you into the Bureau, into the national security mission? And because we do have students listening as well, what advice would you give them in terms of what they ought to be thinking as they pursue similar careers?
Great question. And I often say that you have to have a dream, you have to have a want, and follow that dream. I wanted to be an FBI agent since I was a little boy, and I followed that dream. And then opportunities present themselves. I started my job with the government when I was 21 years old, with the General Services Administration, what got me into the federal service. And I think at the end of the day, to be in the FBI, CIA, NSA, any three-letter agency, or Social Security or IRS, It's a calling, public service. You either have it in your blood or you don't. Police officers, firemen, hospital folks, you have that genetic want to be. And I think if you have it, follow that dream and don't let anything stop you from getting to where you want to be.
Awesome. Thank you. And given your last role at the NCSC, can you paint us a picture of the counterintelligence landscape? I know you put out a major strategy and thought it would be good to just foot stomp a couple of the high points there.
Yeah, I think it's important, Frank, when you talk about where we are in the threat landscape. And I don't think in my lifetime we've ever been in a situation where we've had more complex threats with the ecosystems that we have around our nation and coming from so many different places. Mm-hmm. I think when you look back at the counterintelligence strategy we produced in 2020, you think about a counterintelligence strategy, countering the intelligence apparatus of other nation states. The pillars were critical infrastructure, supply chain, economic security, cyber, foreign influence. They
all
sound like
issues.
A security issue, right? But but it was the first time we actually made a decision to blend not only what the bad guys were doing, but where they're actually doing it and where are the targets of those implications. And I think now we start to see the aspects of cyber and ubiquitous that it is in the United States. It is everywhere in all places.
And Bill, one of the things I give you a ton of props for and credit for is having this conversation with the American people. You think counterintelligence, you think very small doors that no one ever can enter. You found a way, I think, to articulate these issues and also recognition that to succeed, it has to be outside the small alphabet soup of federal agencies that deal with counterintelligence. Anything you want to share on that?
Well, first of all, thanks, Frank. We worked really hard. I was surrounded by a lot of great women and men who gave us the opportunity to not only take crisis and create opportunity, but actually get out there in the public and talk about what Russia and China and Iran were doing in our public space, not against our government. And I think a couple things happened that provided this opportunity with the changing of Xi Jinping coming to power and Putin doing things. And actually was the paradigm shift, not only nation-state threat actors against the U.S. government, but more importantly, that aspect of their doing nefarious activities in the private sector, against our financial services sector, our energy sector, telecom sector. That gave us the opportunity to tell that story that counterintelligence isn't just counter-espionage. Mm-hmm. It isn't just spying on behalf of other countries. It's actual counterintelligence apparatus taking activities here domestically in the United States that's primarily against our corporate entities.
So in a way, what's old is new and new is old again. So I'd like to talk a little bit, maybe not the elephant in the room, but the dragon in the room. Let's talk China. You've been quite outspoken in terms of the Communist Party's intentions and some of their activities. So much to unpack here. Maybe we can start with the state secrets law that has just been updated. Quite honestly, I think it was already pretty darn foolproof, but anything you want to shed some light on some of that?
With reference to the Chinese and the Communist Party of China, I think for your audience, it's really important, specifically the students, to understand that when we talk about the Communist Party of China and the CCP and what they do from a nefarious perspective, it's what the Communist Party does. It's not the Chinese people.
Exactly.
It's not Chinese Americans here in the U.S.
Thank you for underscoring.
Academics. Yep. It's really the evilness of the Communist Party. And when you talk about how that is different, it just in the United States, I think the easiest way to look at this is we are clearly bifurcated between the government, the private corporate world, and the criminal elements of the United States. We're, for the most part, we're pretty, Jersey, Louisiana, maybe not, but for the most part, we're separated. In China, it's not that case. They are one. So the government, the corporations who all are abiding by everything the government does, and the criminal elements all work at the behest of Mother China. It's a different paradigm, and we are foreign to that. So it's hard to explain that here in the United States. And then, like in 2017, Xi and the Communist Party put forward some new cyber laws, two cyber laws and one national security law that really set the tone for their not only their companies, but their employees in those companies and the citizens that said, you shall provide anything at any time that the Communist Party asks you to do, whether it be the party, the MSS, or the PLA. And I think that really set the tone for that really danger zone for joint ventures and partnering with companies inside and outside of China because of the third-party data regulations. And when you partner, you're partnering with them. Your data is now at the behest of that Chinese company. But more importantly, anytime they're asked for that data, they have to provide it to the Communist Party.
And I think that nuance gets lost in a lot of the discussion. So even if the company wanted to become more transparent and live up to international norms in a corporate transparency kind of way, it's not up to them, right?
It's not. And I think that goes for big companies like Tencent and Alibaba, and also down to smaller companies like TikTok, who is the parent company, is ByteDance. So you have an opportunity to look at these things and say, I want to partner with company ABC in Beijing on making widgets. Well, and that partnership comes with data sharing, right? Third-party data, subscribers. You provide that to that company as part of your legal agreements. That data is now available to the intelligence services of the Chinese Communist Party. All they have to do is ask for it. And the law that they passed in 2017 makes it very specific to CISOs, CIOs, and any employee of the company. And then secondarily, the national security law says any Chinese citizen must overturn this data. So for the most part, everyone there, every human, every business entity works for the Communist Party of China.
And they've ratcheted that up and tightened it even further in recent weeks.
They have. And I think at the end of the day, you have to talk about what's the next step beyond that, right?
Exactly.
And I think as their economy continues to slow, I think you'll start to see the screws tighten a little bit more on that and a little bit more aggressive nature from the companies to do this nefarious activity around the globe.
Well, you brought up ByteDance, and a dear friend for transparency, Mike Gallagher, recently introduced a bill with others, bipartisan, to delist ByteDance, at least have U.S. This issue is a very contentious one, but can you maybe help us unpack what the ramifications here are vis-a-vis TikTok and why it's a security risk, if you agree that to be?
I do, and I'm one of those in the grave risk category, right? Because I got to see the classified data. I got to see the FBI investigations, and they still listen to Director Ray and the investigations of what ByteDance does, it can do, and what TikTok is and it isn't. It is one of the greatest social media platforms in the world. I'll give you that.
Very effective.
However, when you download that app and it goes on your phone and you click I agree to the terms and conditions, you are providing a foreign country with access to everything on your phone. Not only forget what they can do to influence you from the algorithms and what videos and
music
which
is powerful in itself.
It is a mind game, especially now. I'm sure we'll talk about disinformation, misinformation as part of the cyber rubric. But more than that, they have access to your data on your phone, your PowerPoints, your text, your emails, your pictures, your calendar, if they so choose. What to me, it's a difference in giving that to Facebook or Instagram, but now you are giving it to a company that is beholden to two intelligence services in the Communist Party of China, our adversary and our enemy. I'm not sure why you would want to do that. Now, the younger generation would say, I don't care if they have our data. It doesn't make a difference to me. Well, it should make a difference to you. And I think we have to do a much better job of explaining that nuance and why it matters to the young people in America.
Oh, that's very well said, well conveyed. And quite honestly, that argument does need to be laid out in very practical, pragmatic, and bottom line common sense sorts of terms. Because I feel like I lose that debate sometimes in my own house.
We all do, Frank. And I think the point you're trying to nail down here is we, from a marketing perspective, we've done poorly, right? We've had multiple congressional hearings. Chairman Gallagher and his entire China committee has been phenomenal with raising these stakes for the small people who get to watch that, mm-hmm. right? There needs to be almost like a public messaging campaign out there where we can say, hey, eyes wide open, here's the threat, how we see it manifesting on the social media app and other maps. You choose to use this app or not, but here's the threat as we see it. And I think we just have to do a better job of putting it out there to the American public and the youth of America.
Yeah, no, well said. And there used to be, I think there's a little hubris in the United States that they are only imitators in China. And right now, I think they're innovating and in some ways out innovating. And I don't think that necessarily will be long term because we've got a lot that can be brought to bear. And quite honestly, we are the country that invented Hollywood, Madison Avenue, all the stories, movies, and Silicon Valley technology mm-hmm. that we're seeing today. But we're somehow getting outrun in this environment and got to do more, I think. Any thoughts there in terms of innovation?
Yeah, I would say factually, I think what happened in my mind is I remember 15 years ago, 2008, 2010, when we started to really take a deep dive onto China, espionage issues, corporate espionage in Hollywood and other places, mm-hmm. and more importantly in DOD. And we would say, yeah, all these ships look like our ships.
Pretty similar.
All these planes look, but you know what? They can't float and they can't fly.
Yeah. Yep.
Because all the organic talent from China was coming here to study in the United States and they were staying here. Mm-hmm. And we were gaining that impetus of that amazing brain talent out of Beijing and other parts of China. Xi Jinping came in power in 2013. He started to change that rubric. He started to say, hey, our best and brightest engineers will continue to go to the U.S. and U.K. However, you're coming back.
Yep.
So that organic engineering capability, innovation, thought process, and implementation of the sciences went back to Beijing. So those planes and ships started to float more effectively, fly more aggressively, and now our F-35, they have exactly the same plane that flies the same way. Now, we still have advantages from more of a more technical perspective, mm-hmm. I'll leave mm-hmm. it at that, but they're getting traction because those ideations, those innovations are coming back to China, and I think that really helps close the gap for Xi and China on all things technical.
And he's made very clear, when we talk about intentions of the Communist Party of China, they're not secret. They're as public could be public, are they not?
They are, and I think you got to give them credit for being transparent about not only what their goals are every mm-hmm. 5 years, but how they're going to go get those goals, right? Mm-hmm. And I think when looking at the five-year plan, China 2025, they're all integrated, and every year they change a little bit, but for the most part, they'll tell you aerospace and space, number one, advanced agriculture is number mm-hmm. two, quantum, biopharm, number three or four. Then you go into like advanced manufacturing. They'll tell you. So then you get the classified clandestine collection of what they're trying to do. And then you go out to the public and these companies say, yeah, we've been breached. We've had an insider threat. We've mm-hmm. had cyber penetrations in those same categories. So they make it very clear what their goals are. We just do not do an effective job of not only transmitting this to the corporate world, but having an ability to help them protect as they are. And that's just not with, you know, the big Pfizer's of the world and Johnson & Johnson, but it's the subsidiaries and the vendors and the supply chain who are most often the targeted from those capabilities in biopharma or in aerospace. It's not the Bell helicopter. It's not NASA.
Third-party vendors.
It's the fifth-party vendors and sixth-party vendors that they're strategically going after. And they do it in a way not just from cyber or not just in an insider threat program, but hybrid ways where they do a human-enabled cyber, but mm-hmm. also non-traditional collectors, scientists, engineers, salespeople, any way into that business, they have a holistic process for which they attack a corporation. And I think we are not good at talking about that holistic threat to a particular corporation or a sector.
Anything on the talent, since you jumped into some of the non-traditional collectors, anything you want to?
Yeah, they've been successful. They being the Communist Party of China, mm-hmm. in developing not only talent programs, lots of them, but being very specific to particular sectors of the area. The one that comes most clearly to mind is academia, right? Mm-hmm. Where they spent time in the last decade really cultivating professors, scientists, engineers in high-level research, not only in universities and colleges, but in research institutions, and recruiting them into their talent programs. Some of them unwitting, some of them not, right? So they join these talent programs and provide, I would say, shadow operations back in China, and that provides an opportunity for them to get ahead. They don't have the type of patent program we have here in the U.S. that's just lethargic and old and legacy. They can go to market with technology tomorrow and be selling that same capability on the market for 30 cents on a dollar before we even get to a place where we're ready to go for trials at the NSF or NIH, right? I think that's the strategic advantage they have with those people in the talent pools that they put here in the U.S. and bring back.
You know, you brought up patents, and I'm reminded of an old that the Soviets during the Cold War put such, all of our information was available at the U.S. Patent Office. They held it in such high regard. Every day you would have KGB officers. It was called Comrade Regpatov, Comrade right. Patent. I think there's a story, I cannot remember the veracity of it, that we were sometimes putting in some information that maybe caused them to spend money in areas that wasn't so easily designed. But what do you think of when you think of innovation, when you think of patents and intellectual property, and why steal secrets? Because why spend the money in the R&D if you can get it for free and invest all the money in gaining market share or coming up with new bells and whistles to make something better. But what are your thoughts on that?
So, well,
because you just brought up patents, and it's a great story.
You just
story.
Answered your own question. I think the way you laid that out is perfect.
I've never had an unspoken thought.
Right.
You know that.
But sometimes the blind squirrel gets her way. I think that was perfectly laid out as to the process for which they do this. And I would proffer to you, America is still number one in the world from ideation to innovation, to marketing, to manufacturing, to go to market. We're still number one in the world.
But we can't take it for granted.
But where we are horrific is the patent process.
Mm-hmm.
As much as we've expedited our capabilities to develop from A to Z, the patent process has not followed suit, right? Mm-hmm. So oftentimes technology in the mind and the way we apply it moves at light speed. But how we get a patent from each individual company is legacy-based, it's slow, lethargic, and it's still, I would say, transparent so much that it allows our adversaries to come in and evaluate, whether they're Iranian, North Korean, the scientists from China, Indonesia, and it doesn't make a difference. And that collaborative mindset in the patent world is problematic for spies who want to steal that information.
And this may sound like heresy, but should we just assume everything's been compromised?
Well, that would be a little bit going way dark. I would be
Darth Vader, or where do you?
I would be oftentimes accused of being on the dark side for sure. But sometimes the facts matter, right?
Yep, yep.
When we lay the facts out, it's a dark story. But I would say that oftentimes we have to look really closely. And you referenced this: what do our adversaries want?
Mm-hmm.
And if we know what they want, which we often do, either through the great work of our intelligence collections around the world, or from them basically just saying it, we need to protect those things.
Yep.
And we
yep.
can't protect everything, but we could triage what we know for a fact they want. Two big things right now, quantum and AI, we are moving fast and furious, but we are not putting the requisite amount of security around those bubbles to protect that. And what I don't want to have happen is 5 years from now, 8 years from now, you and I are testifying in Congress, so we're having this podcast again. How do we lose all this technology?
Exactly.
That's what's going to happen.
And not to put a fine point on it, but we cannot afford to lose those two races. When you're talking quantum in particular, that's the ability to have uncrackable secrets and the ability to crack everyone's secrets. So it's the old cryptology set of issues on steroids. And AI, same sort of questions. But am I wrong with that?
You're right. And I would say I'm going to quadruple down on this issue. When I list a long-term and short-term threats that we face from a technology innovation perspective, I would put quantum number one and AI number two.
Mm-hmm.
And I think not only are we federated how we do that here in the United States, our adversaries are very clear what they're looking for as well. And they're looking at the same capabilities. And the race for quantum is, I would say, quietly, like it was the missile race and the ICBMs in the 60s and 70s. But this is more quiet. I saw a stat recently where there's about 500,000, 450,000 to 500,000 vacant cyber jobs in the U.S. Cyber is everything, right?
Yeah.
But from a quantum perspective, it's the most misunderstood and secret area of technology and research development that we have. Because unless you're in that space, very technical, highly minded space, you have no idea what quantum is. And to me, the ability to break encryption, yes, all the stuff from decades ago from NSA, FBI, CIA, but more importantly, even today, Frank, think about all the Indian encryption apps that we have, whether it be WhatsApp, Signal, Apple. Somebody has the capability one day to break an encryption, you win
everything.
And then
everything.
In order to do that, what helps quantum research is AI, right? And an ability for any country or any organization to develop speed of action AI capabilities, you need data.
Mm-hmm.
And let's look at who's stolen the most data in the last 15 years.
I'm really glad you brought that up, because sometimes you wonder why you're vacuuming data and the like, but maybe it is to titrate and calibrate and recalibrate algorithms and other sorts of models. Is that kooky talk from me, or?
No, it's exactly right. I've obviously been in the space for a long time with respect to data theft. And we've seen the Communist Party of China steal more data in a decade than the history of the world combined, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you ask yourself, is it all for espionage purposes? No. Some of it is, right? The OPM data hack from Anthem, and then you look at the financial services hacks, the hospital hacks, Travel, Marriott, Target. There's a lot of hacks, mm-hmm. right? And then you look at the Equifax.
You blink and you missed one, yeah, probably since we're here.
They don't even make headline news anymore. Definitely they don't even make the front page of the newspaper anymore. So yes, can they put a dossier together for you and I from a data perspective? They sure can, right? All of our OPM files, our background and clearances, where we shop, how we shop, what hospitals we have, yes. But in order to drive AI development, you need reams of data.
Mm-hmm.
Think about all the data they've stolen over the years and mm-hmm. given to their big corporations, whether it be Tencent and Alibaba. The ability to use that data to drive their AI development is second to none in the world, right? And we are slowly getting better at it, but we don't have the requisite pots of data
exactly.
that we have not stolen that data on the world.
And some of that data, for good reason, due to privacy and other concerns, isn't available to a single entity in the United States either, right?
It isn't, right? So I'm talking about the actual stolen data.
Yeah.
That doesn't include all the legitimate data the Chinese Communist Party has purchased throughout the last 10 years legally through data brokers.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you look at, there's big companies out there, Experian or Accenture, there's a lot of companies that sell data, bulk data. They don't not sell it to countries or companies in other and around the world. So there's been a large activity focused mindset for the Communist Party trying to purchase legal data from around
mm-hmm.
the world, and not just the US, but in Europe as well. So that adds to the capability to not only provide a nefarious dossier in you and I, but actually drive a lot of their AI development.
So building on and another question, the Biden administration recently promulgated a new executive order around port security, recognizing mm-hmm. that we haven't onshored U.S. cranes for quite some time, and I think some people, including yourself, have been ringing the bell. That is a security consideration. And I do want to discuss, I think we are in part to blame because we've offshored way too much over the years in the United States. But before we get into that discussion, let's talk the executive order in particular, and why do you think that is relevant, if you do?
Frank, I'm glad you brought this up. This has been one of my bells ringing the last mm-hmm. couple of years that I think I'm excited about the executive order. We'll get there in a second. But I want to just build what this picture looks like. So approximately 80 to 85% of our ports in the United States are controlled, run from moving shipments from ships, cargo, on and off by ZPMC cranes.
Mm-hmm.
ZPMC is a Chinese-based company that provides not only the capability to move a container from a ship to shore to ship, but move it in and out of the ports, categorize it, track it. That comes with people, engineers, software that's tied in all over the country. It's a great technology that works. I call it the Huawei 2.0,
mm-hmm.
right? It's a legitimate business capability of which there is really no competition that also resembles itself as an intelligence collection capability, as well as a potential supply chain disruptor in time of need.
And if you think back to COVID, supply chains became front and center, and in time of greatest need, if it ain't working, it ain't working.
It isn't, right? And I think you look at COVID, then post-COVID, we saw not only the unionized issues where there was strikes and walkouts, not only with rail and freight, but the longshoremen. That's a problem that we can handle. I think the president got involved in that and negotiated. If the Chinese decide to shut our ports down with their cranes,
yep.
That's a diplomatic issue. It's a military issue. It's an economic issue.
You can't deploy forces. You can't project power. You can't get food shelves stocked. You can't get pretty much anything a modern society is dependent upon. And I don't remember the exact statistic, but when the executive order was announced, I think Ann Neuberger was saying that ports are responsible for over $4 trillion of our economy. So this is not trivial.
It's not trivial, and it's an economic burden. So we talk about a lot of these podcasts, and a lot of things we're talking about is how the Chinese are prepping the battlefield here in the U.S.
Yep.
from a cyber perspective. Mm-hmm. But it starts with the ports. Starts outside in, right? Critical infrastructure, I would proffer, our ports are critical infrastructure.
Absolutely.
And the ability for us to be, the inability of us to commission a ship to move out to the Pacific to help Taiwan in time of need, right?
No kidding.
So it's a military issue as well. So all these cranes, again, 85% of our ports are controlled by these cranes. Some would believe that they're all tied in, connected from a software perspective, which they are, and as well as what connectivity or ability does the Chinese Communist Party have to shut that down when they choose to, right? It's problematic.
And often I complain about unfunded mandates, but there is some funding attached to this, right? But we don't have the capacity right now, or do we? I know there's some subsidiaries out of Finland, Japan, and elsewhere where we can start onshoring this. But we got to redouble that effort, whether it's chips, whether it's cranes, you name it.
To your point, Frank, I think that this is the CHIPS and Science Act times 10, right?
Yeah.
And I think you're really putting the money where the mouth is. Now, we did this with Huawei.
By the way, those cranes are run on chips too, so right. I'm not sure which one's times 10,
right.
But yeah.
And I was going to get there, but Huawei, we provided all kinds of money for telecommunications vendors around the U.S., to rip and replace.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they haven't done it yet. I think the current estimate is less than 10% of that money has been spent.
Yep.
Rip and replace to what?
Yeah.
So my argument here, I think the White House did a good job of laying out, here's the money, but here's how we're going to mitigate the threat. Mm-hmm. We're not going to replace the cranes, right? But we can take a really aggressive look at the software capabilities, and we can look at the hardware, and then maybe replace some of the software with U.S.-based software to protect us in the short term and the long term if we get into a pre-conflict issue with the Chinese. I think that's not only the implementation plan, but the fact that they put money to it is phase A, but phase B is, okay, where are we going to spend that money to mitigate the threat that's posed by these cranes?
And I agree with that, because these things do cost money, and we've sold too much of that capacity that we just have to bring back home, and hopefully we do get our arms around all that. Let's use anything else on the ports and the executive order in particular that you want to foot stomp?
No, I just want to put the ports and the cranes, Frank, in the same category as the holistic threat we see and hear about with the threats to our critical infrastructure. We've recently heard about Vault Typhoon and what we've identified them doing. And I would say the last decade we've seen the Communist Party of China and the Russians, for that matter, penetrate our critical infrastructure. I would remind your listeners and viewers that the ports and the cranes are part of that critical infrastructure.
Yeah. You know, have you ever seen the TV show The Wire?
Yes.
So season two is about the ports, and it was pretty thoughtful in terms of how it shaped some of these issues. But not to go down that rabbit hole, which I tend to do. But let's look at supply chain writ large, because I think this is one example of a broader set of issues. I had the privilege of leading an effort in the previous administration around economic security, looking at the authorities and capabilities. And I think you briefed my group when this was for the Secretary of DHS. I concluded we don't have visibility of our supply chains. We need it. The reality is the federal government isn't necessarily going to be best positioned to even know what's in the supply chain. Would you agree with that, disagree with that?
I would agree wholeheartedly. And I think because we're a capitalist society, there's no really need for the government to know that stuff.
Yep.
However, I would say that we can't forget recent crises. So we look back to COVID, and we had the supply chain problems that we probably didn't even fathom, and how much of that was caused by the Communist Party of China's siphoning of, forget just PPE, everything else. Mm-hmm. And I think that it should have been a wake-up call to say, not only do we have to start manufacturing domestically some of these critical elements, forget just batteries, but toilet paper, right? And all the things that we need, masks for emergencies, we need to start to have the ability to manufacture here domestically. And I'm not sure we remember any of that from 2020 to 21. Yeah, I do. Yeah. And then the difficulty we had.
Short-term memory sometimes.
And then from a supply chain perspective, even developing the new vaccine was a supply chain issue, right? So supply chain, there's a reason why it's the number two pillar in the counterintelligence strategy for America, because it does matter.
So can you give a little bit of color on, during the development of the vaccine, some of the counterintelligence implications? And I'm not sure what you can discuss publicly, but fascinating stories there.
Yeah. So let's start with Operation Warp Speed.
Mm-hmm.
Not a lot of people know about that, but General Perna led that effort from the Army, and it was a multifaceted, multi-agency operation to not only develop a vaccine from ideation to delivery into your arm, but also protect that from our adversaries, primarily the Chinese, who from the very beginning were looking to not only steal that technology, but disrupt our ability to manufacture it, freeze it, deliver it, disseminate it, and then get it into your arm. So it was really an amazing operation of what the United States of America can do in time of crisis. And I say can do with the U.S. government, with the states and locals, the state police, the local law enforcement, the pharmaceutical companies, the manufacturing, the delivery mechanisms, all working in one cohesive unit to get to a place where we could have a vaccine. Say what you want about whether you're pro-vaccine, anti-vaccine.
Yeah,
it's irrelevant here.
It's
irrelevant.
Technology.
It's our ability as Americans to find a solution expeditiously when we want to, and using all tools to our capabilities, to include the counterintelligence tools that we utilized in this apparatus to not only provide disinformation, misinformation to our adversaries, but to sometimes obfuscate what we're doing and where we're doing it, to provide the ability for us to win in creating this vaccine. It was a fascinating operation, and kudos go to Department of Defense and all agencies who participated, as well as our state and local representatives who worked to provide a solution to a big problem.
So what I'm really hearing, without getting into detail, there was some creativity on our own planning to potentially obfuscate our plan.
There was some really good, not only strategic intent, there was forwarding of missions, and there was a really, I would say, a stretch of capabilities and authorities that we need in time of crisis that sometimes we wouldn't normally have on an everyday basis. Some tools we used that we didn't know we had in our toolbox that we could utilize, whether it be Title 10, Title 50, somewhere in the middle, Title 70, Title 11. Sometimes we did what we needed to do as a country to make sure that we could effectively create a vaccine before adversaries did, and before they actually rendered that neutered it, so we couldn't create it.
Sounds like a story, when it can be told, we need to bring you back to discuss. So we spent a lot of time talking about the CCP, their intentions, their capabilities. Who else rises to the top of your list? And the reality is pretty much anyone with an intelligence service, I would think, but I'd be curious what you think.
Yeah. So I think in my book, Frank, there's five groups. You have China, Russia, Iran, North Korea, and the state-sponsored. And then you have, I would call, terrorism and hacktivists in one group. They would be the fifth shop, right?
Anyone with an axe to grind,
right,
plus FTOs.
True. So I spent a lot of time on terrorism. And what transcends my career, from the criminal organizations to counterterrorism to counterintelligence, is one thing: cyber. Right? They all use cyber as a tool and modality, conduct their operations, and to use it as one of the levers or one of their tools in their toolboxes. Al-Qaeda did it very well, right? They did it from misinformation, from a recruitment perspective, successfully. When you look at China and what the capabilities are, they dwarf everybody else connected. Sometimes you'll hear people, well, cyber espionage, corporate espionage, there's really not a lot of harm. A lot of Sony harmed by North Korea? I would argue they were, right? I think they lost not only all their computer capabilities, $500 million instantly, but all the IP from their stolen new movies, right? So there is, look at the cyber capabilities we saw from 17 to 20, Maersk, the amount of money that they lost, right?
Huge.
So you could say it's ransomware.
Russia.
No, it's not. It's cyber, right? Yeah. At the end of the day. So yes, there is harm. There is a detrimental capabilities for global ecosystems, the movement of trade. So I think if to answer your question, those four countries for different aspects, right? China needs us like a parasite. They need our economy to be able to facilitate Xi Jinping's number one aspect, to be the geopolitical, economic, and military leader of the world. Mm-hmm. Russia, very capable, more strategic, more tactical with what they want to go at. Iran is a caged animal. You just never know. They love their dams, their waterways, and they love their financial services. And I think North Korea, out of anger, right? One thing in common, though, I will proffer to you all of the organizations out there, the hacking groups, whether it be R-Evil, Vault Typhoon, they're all part-timers working for and on behest of the nation state threat actors. You very rarely are going to find a hacking group out there that's independent of one of those four countries.
And if not independent, at least they're provided safe haven from one of those countries. I really do think a much more delineated clarification of proxies and their roles is going to be a big set of issues going forward. And I look back to state-sponsored terrorism. You had different levels in the 80s in terms of how you would respond. I think we need the same from a policy standpoint around cyber. That said, I'm not sure we know enough just yet to be able to do that with the granularity that I think we need to do. Let me ask you, you mentioned earlier misinformation, disinformation. You even mentioned Al-Qaeda and their attempt to use internet-facilitated radicalization, inspire Shabab, all those. It may have been Blair Witch Project, but then Inspire was actually kind of pretty sophisticated in terms of their use. But how would you translate that then to nation state actors? What do we need to be thinking about? Elections and everything else?
Yeah, we could start with elections and mm-hmm. go backwards. The 2024 election, if you think for 1 second that all those nation state threat actors aren't going to play in this, you're fooling
think
yourself,
again.
Right?
Yep.
And I think when you think about cyber, it's everywhere. It's from your phone. Every electric vehicle is basically a phone with wheels, right?
Mm-hmm.
To the critical infrastructure, the counterintelligence, the IT and the OT, operational technology, misinformation, disinformation, what's in X or Twitter, mm-hmm. what's online with Instagram, Facebook, all of that is cyber-derived bots and trolls. And the ability, what we saw with the Russians take a new stand in 2020 was amplifying our own U.S. citizens' discussions and anger, right? So we saw in 2016.
The pouring gasoline on fissures that somewhat existed, but doubling down on that, right?
16, it was more bots and trolls, and NSA did a good job of neutralizing them in 20, because they went to say, okay, if Bill and Frank are going to argue about something, we're going to amplify them with mm-hmm. the trolls and the bots. And then now you have a U.S. person saying bad things about candidate A or B.
Mm-hmm.
And my aspect here is that's a lot of cyber-derived capabilities that the American public just isn't aware of. And I think we talked about this previously. Where is that focal point going to be for truth, right?
Mm-hmm.
And what is going to be the truth? And that, as we move forward to 2024 in November, what are the American people going to think about when they see a potential deepfake? Is it real? Is that really Frank talking about The Sopranos last episode? Or is it, but it sounds like Bill's voice. It looks like Frank, but we know James Gandolfini is dead. How was he in the video, right?
Exactly.
And then how do we then, where does that individual go for help and say, is this a real video?
And what are your thoughts on that?
I think we have to find a quasi-governmental entity. It can't be the government.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, the lack of trust in the government can't be denied. I think there has to be maybe a quasi-governmental consortium where we can go to say it's an independent organization. Hey, I see this video of Frank, or it could be President Biden or candidate Trump. Is it really them? There needs to be a home base for that. Even if the answer is we don't know, it can't really be the government, because right now we have to regain the trust of American
Absolutely.
People from the government.
But
there's
media
private
has a deficit of trust in some ways too, does it not?
It does. And I think media has, went in their corners.
Mm-hmm.
They picked a side. And I think there needs to be an opportunity for someone to come out of that and say, we're not going to pick a side. We're going to be in the middle. And that middle might be an FFRDC tied in with an organization that's a nonprofit to say, we're going to do our best. So if you see a news story online in 2020, you'd hit rumors. Hey, there has been an attack, a hack on election voting machines in state X. Mm-hmm. Was that true? Where do you go find that out? Because next thing you know, it's trolling on Fox or CNN, it might not even be true. So I think, to your point, the media has a big responsibility here going forward to vet what's true and not true and provide the American people the facts as they see it and not speculate.
And as an individual, the algorithms are going to reaffirm your views on whatever it is, right? At the end of the day, this was an issue we were looking at on those that were potentially being pulled into the jihadist sphere. They keep seeing the same thing that reaffirms, in my views, their very aberrant attitudes in terms of violence and the like, but they kept getting more and more and more and more that was this echo chamber that reaffirmed some of that. So we got to be thinking about what that looks like.
Frank, one of the core tenets of counterintelligence is psychological warfare, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's the ability to mend minds and sow doubt in anything. Mm-hmm. So you think about what the terrorists were able to do, right?
Yeah.
And not even just providing sympathy or empathy, but look, take that terrorist mindset that I think Hezbollah did a really good job at over the years, and now fast forward to today with the conflict in Israel and in Gaza and Hezbollah and Hamas. And you start to see now the changing of the mindset globally because of the significant efforts that Hezbollah and Hamas and other terrorist organizations are doing on the airwaves to change the focus to the innocent bystanders of Palestinians, where the Israelis are not spending that time and effort on what actually happened back in October. So you start to see that psychological operations change. And I look at folks I know now and I say, wait a minute, you believe X? And I know 5-7 years ago that was a false narrative, but it's become true. The old adage, if you say something enough, it becomes true. That goes back to the early days of the KGB.
Yeah.
And so that mindset.
AIDS in Africa.
Yes.
Right? Yeah.
It still happens. It still works. And it's one of those things where if it worked 30 years ago, it still might work today.
So I want to close with the discussion. So you and I, for transparency, know each other quite well. Not many things we fully disagree on, but maybe one where we maybe have a little nuanced, different argument is around ransomware and whether or not the victims should pay or not pay ransom. At one end, I would argue if you pay, why have ransomware? Because we're paying ransom. And at the end of the day, we need to do more to ultimately support the victims, but not fuel the ransomware organizations, which are growing exponentially. And I would argue for government institutions, maybe there should be a ban of payment. For companies, I don't think that's the government's decision to make. But how would you unpack this debate?
You framed it very well. And I would hearken back to don't pay the terrorist. If you pay the terrorists, they're going to continue to terrorize,
that's where
right?
It comes from, yeah. Yep.
I think that's a false narrative when it comes to ransomware, because typically it was a hostage that was being taken. You wanted a body back. Look at ransomware over the last 7 years. Early on, it was shutting down the systems and you were paying or not paying to have your systems turned back on. Now it's a combination of that plus the theft of your data. I had an opinion about this when I was in the government and subsequent to 2021. Now that I have clients who've been victimized, I have a completely different mindset. I'm a big believer in that you should pay the ransom. You should do what you need to do expeditiously to get your business back up and running. You have to ask yourself, what's my downtime I could survive? And without that, now I will, with a caveat, Frank, I do recommend to the clients, and I do look at success, that if you're going to pay, make sure you do it with the FBI next to you, right? Because at the end of the day, the FBI's capabilities to track that money, whether it be in crypto or cash, is very good. So if you're going to take the effort, you're going to make the business decision to pay to get your data back, do it with the FBI there. Now, they will advise you not to pay with a wink. But if you're going to pay, have them there so they could target that money, track it, so you can potentially get it back at the day with your data. So I think that's my mindset. Business has to continue. And because we have not done a good job with resiliency and redundancy in the private sector, you oftentimes have a decision to make. And my decision and my support to them is keep your business running.
Got to agree to disagree a little bit on that one. I don't think there's a right or a wrong answer, and it's actually not even an ethical set of questions. But the reality is, if we don't stop, it is a little bit like negotiating with terrorists, and there wouldn't be hostages taken if we didn't pay. I think right now, when it comes to life-saving organizations, hospitals and the like, that's a very different and unique set of questions. But you and I have to have this debate offline. Bill, what questions didn't I ask that I should have?
Frank, I think you framed out the conversation very appropriately, and I think the issues we talked about are significant, and some other, like to your point of, there's really no perfect answer here. However, I'd like to spend a little time talking about what happens after an event, right? Mm-hmm. So we're all worried about the attack on our critical infrastructure, a cyber event, Colonial Pipeline 2.0, the power going out. I think some of the things I advise my clients on are important for your listeners and viewers. Be prepared. Mm-hmm. Be prepared. What does that mean? That means having a little stash of power bars and water in each trunk of your car, having maybe buy and invest in a generator if power's out for 4 or 5 days. At the same time, let's go back to the future. Think about having a hard line in your phone. 2 weeks ago, we had phone lines that were down. Mass panic ensued, right? And that mm-hmm. was just a few hours. I would say if you have a managed service provider, get a hard line. Have an emergency plan with your family that if power goes out, communications go out, phones go out, where you're going to meet in an hour, where you're going to meet in 3 hours, where you're going to meet in 6 hours. What's that action plan? And practice it once or twice a year. Mm-hmm. But have that plan for sustainability for 3 days, 3 to 5 days in your house with food and water, as well as your vehicles, and then exercise that plan. But from a communications perspective, you have to assume there are phone lines are going to go down or cellular mobile devices. So let's think back to getting back to our hard line in our home.
Bill, thank you for bringing that home, making it real. Resilience, I think, is more than a buzzword. We need to be doing more and prepare for that bad day. Thank you for your public service for all these years and continuing to fight the good fight. And thank you for being a senior fellow of ours and for spending so much time with us today. We're in a better place because of your leadership, and just wanted to say thank you. Until next week, stay safe, stay strong, stay curious. Thank you.
Thanks, Frank.